Welcome to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. Many of you have been here before. As you may recall, we hold such events here at the Independent Institutes Conference Center on a regular basis. They consist of seminars, debates, and lectures on many different public issues. Our discussion this evening is entitled Preemptive War, a New U.S. Empire? And we're happy to feature a number of books that we hope each of you will get copies of. The first is by Ivan Eland called Putting Defense Back into U.S. Defense Policy. The second one by Edward Olson is called U.S. National Defense for the 21st Century. And third is Political Islam, edited by Joel Bainan. In the registration packets that many of you hopefully got, you'll find further information about our program, including books and events we hold. We also invite you to visit our website at independent.org. Next Monday, we're going to be unveiling a new website that we've been working on for about a year called onpower.org. And I think you'll find that it's very relevant to this evening's discussion. You may also subscribe to our weekly email newsletter, which is called The Lighthouse. So those of you who have not left your email address with us, I encourage you to do so. We also advise people and notify them of upcoming events and media programs by email on a regular basis. Before I introduce our speakers, I thought I'd just recount a sampling of a few news items. Number one, no weapons of mass destruction have yet been found. Here are a few quotes from the commander-in-chief and the drumbeat leading up to and after the war in Iraq. Quote, right now, Iraq is expanding and improving facilities that were used for the production of biological weapons, unquote, September 12, 2002. Quote, the evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists. A group he calls Nuclear Mujahideen, his nuclear holy warriors. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year, unquote, October 7, 2002. Quote, we have sources that tell us that Saddam Hussein recently authorized Iraqi field commanders to use chemical weapons, the very weapons the dictator tells us he does not have, February 8, 2003. Quote, intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. The regime has already used weapons of mass destruction. That's March 17, 2003. Quote, we found the weapons of mass destruction. You know, we found biological laboratories, and we'll find more weapons as time goes on. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons, they're wrong. We found them, unquote, from a statement during his recent trip to Poland in May of this year. In a word, strategery. Despite claims to the contrary and a response to violent street protests, the U.S. government meeting U.S. citizens will begin paying up to 250,000 former Iraqi soldiers beginning on July 14th. In addition, the U.S. will be paying to form a new Iraqi army trained and equipped by the U.S. government. Force size will be in the neighborhood of something between 12,000 and 40,000. Hence, the Iraqi army is now a division of the Pentagon. An avid supporter of the war in Iraq, Senator Joseph Biden, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, stated this past Monday that, quote, I think we're going to be here in a big way with forces and economic input for a minimum of 3 to 5 years. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer has said that it is an open question as to how long it will take to establish security and stability in Iraq. And number four's news item, as of this week, nearly half as many Americans have been killed in war incidents since the end of the Iraqi war. Estimates of more than between 2,000 and 10,000 innocent civilian Iraqis have been killed since the war began. As Senator Robert Byrd has recently stated, quote, are we any safer today than we were on March 18th, 2003. Over 100 years ago, the U.S. embarked on another war, the Spanish-American War. At the time, media coverage of the matter was a total disgrace, something that perhaps rings a bell. It exemplified what became known as yellow journalism in its worst form. For example, Joseph Pulitzer, the publisher of the New York World, and William Randolph Hearst, publisher of the New York Journal, collaborated to invent reams of imaginary events, demonizing the rulers of Cuba as brutal butchers. They succeeded in inflaming the American public, and Congress declared war on Spain. In response, there also arose a group of influential people who opposed foreign interventionism, which they understood as having nothing to do with protecting the lives of American citizens, but everything to do with using government power for special interest purposes. This group included Mark Twain, Andrew Carnegie, William James, David Starr Jordan, Samuel Gompers, George Boutwell, and others, who formed what was called the Anti-Imperialist League. The League's platform stated, quote, "Much as we abhor the war of criminal aggression in the Philippines, greatly as we regret the blood of the Filipinos is on American hands, we more deeply resent the betrayal of American institutions at home." Simultaneously, or actually before, I think just before this was occurred, the Committee on American Interests was also organized by various business interests to support the war effort in order to obtain a military base in the Far East to protect investments in China and elsewhere in the region. The ultimate result of this war was the U.S. seizure and annexation of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, and including the 1899 Philippine insurrection against the U.S. occupation, the death of 5,462 Americans, untold numbers of Cubans, and hundreds of thousands of Filipinos died in the process. From then until now, U.S. foreign policy has been one of expanding global presence, and that is our topic tonight. In the aftermath of 9/11, President Bush has announced a policy of preemptive unilateral intervention. In Bush's case, such measures are aimed at organizations and countries that may threaten the security of the United States or may develop weapons of mass destruction. But this post-9/11 policy of U.S. intervention is actually one that's been proposed by certain neoconservative writers going back over 10 years. The questions we want to raise tonight are, what is the background to such ideas? What's the background of the Mideast? What is the track record of foreign intervention there and elsewhere? In the aftermath of the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime, will the U.S. be staging further interventions using Iraq as an outpost? What about Korea? What about Iran? To explore these and related issues, we're very pleased to have an excellent panel of distinguished foreign policy experts. I'd like to start out by introducing our first speaker, who is Joel Bainan. Joel is professor of Middle Eastern history at Stanford University. He's the past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America and a contributing editor of the Middle East Report, and many of the essays for the Middle East Report are republished in this book. He received his PhD in history from the University of Michigan. He's been a fellow at Stanford Humanities Institute, as well as having been a Pew Fellow, Fulbright Fellow, and a Hewlett Faculty Fellow. Among his other books are Workers and Peasants in the Modern Middle East, The Dispersion of Egyptian Jewry, Intifada, and Workers on the Nile. I'm very pleased to introduce Joel Bainan.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Does this work? As David Thoreau has just told you, it is now widely recognized that the Bush administration lied to the American people and to the world about its reasons for going to war with Iraq. Presidents have lied before when taking the nation to war, even before the Spanish-American War. We could start with the Mexican-American War, and most of us in this room will remember well the Gulf of Tonkin incident being trumped up as a reason to escalate the Vietnam War. What is new, though, is that the neoconservative ideologues of the Bush II administration have openly proclaimed a policy of imperial domination, preemptive use of military force, and disregard of the alliances and international institutions in which the United States has participated since the end of World War II. The neoconservative ideologues and some liberals like Michael Ignatieff and Thomas Friedman have argued that an American empire would be a benign affair, and so we ought to have it. In response, I want to make two arguments. First, the Bush II administration's Middle East policy did not emerge from nothing. There is a long history of U.S. intervention, covert action, proxy wars, and direct military intervention in the Middle East by both Democratic and Republican administrations since the end of World War II. The significance of the new policy is that because of the ideological commitments of the neoconservatives, this policy far exceeds the traditional concerns of both Republican and Democratic administrations since World War II, which have been primarily to secure the political stability and control of the oil of the Persian Gulf. Second, I want to argue that global domination, indeed the long-term secure control of even the Middle East, is beyond the reach of the United States. This is obscured from the view of Washington policymakers today because of their ideological commitments, just as those commitments impeded an accurate assessment of intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction, the sort of reception American troops would receive in Iraq, and prospects for democracy in post-war Iraq. Therefore, while in the short run this policy will serve the interests of Kellogg, Brown & Root, Bechtel, and other corporations which will benefit from the drive to privatize the Iraqi economy, in the long term, even as it wreaks havoc and destruction, this policy is almost sure to fail. The stakes in the Persian Gulf are well known. The region is the repository of about two-thirds of the world's known petroleum reserves. In 1945, a State Department report declared that this oil constituted, quote, a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history, unquote. This is as true now as it was then. Saudi Arabia is the largest single depository of proven oil reserves in the world, with about 21% of the known total. Iraq is number two, with about 11% of the global total. Moreover, most of Iraq's oil potential is untapped. Only 15 of Iraq's known 70 oil fields are now developed. At least 8 of the remaining fields have reserves of over 1 billion barrels. Many sites likely to contain oil deposits have not yet been explored. We could begin a history of American intervention in the Persian Gulf as early as the 1953 CIA coup in Iran, which is directly connected to the fierce anti-Americanism of the Iranian Revolution. But for reasons of time, I'll begin a decade and a half later. The British Empire, predecessor to the American Empire in the Persian Gulf, got underway with the British occupation of Aden in 1839. After losing a guerrilla war to South Yemeni guerrillas fighting for independence in 1967, Britain announced that it would withdraw all of its forces from the Persian Gulf east of Suez by the end of 1971. At about the same time, January-February 1968, the Tet Offensive by the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam made it clear that short of using nuclear weapons, the United States was going to lose the war in Vietnam. In response to these two events, the United States, under the Nixon presidency, devised a strategy to defend conservative and Islamic oil-producing states, primarily Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, against the threat of secular Arab nationalism, which at that time was embodied in Nasserism, led by Egypt's President Gamal Abdel Nasser, and the Ba'ath Party regimes of Syria and Iraq. In the summer of 1969, the Nixon-Kissinger Doctrine was released. It relied on the formation of what were called regional influentials. We would arm them, train them, support them politically, and they would fight to preserve American interests around the world. In the Persian Gulf, this policy assumed the form of the two-pillar policy, and the two pillars were Iran and Saudi Arabia, who bought, paid in cash from oil profits, enormous amounts of American weaponry during the 1970s and after the Iranian Revolution, then the 1980s, only Saudi Arabia. Israel was also part of this strategy, but Israel was responsible for the Eastern Mediterranean and not the Persian Gulf. There has been a consistent but failed effort on the part of United States policymakers for the Middle East to separate the question of oil from the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 brought an end to the two-pillar policy because one of the pillars collapsed. American planners therefore moved towards the capacity for direct military intervention in the Persian Gulf. In 1979, shortly after the Iranian Revolution, President Carter established the Rapid Deployment Force. In his State of the Union address for 1980, President Carter stated the following: "An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." In other words, the United States would intervene to protect the supply and the price of oil. President Carter and then President Reagan proceeded to engage in two regional proxy wars. First, there was support for Iraq in attacking Iran in 1980 and throughout most of the Iraq-Iran War, which lasted until 1988. There was, in fact, a quasi-alliance between the United States and Iraq during those years, perhaps most pithily symbolized by Donald Rumsfeld shaking Saddam Hussein's hand when he met him in Baghdad on December 20th of 1983. The other proxy war was American support for the anti-Soviet Mujahideen fighting against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which began in December of 1979. The Reagan administration, both of those wars were joint Carter and Reagan administration supported. The Reagan administration continued this policy by supporting Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. This was in the framework of Secretary of State Alexander Haig's anti-Soviet strategic consensus policy. Haig believed that Israel would in fact be attacking Syria, which he saw as a Soviet proxy, and therefore this war would be justified in that framework. Nothing of the sort actually happened. President Reagan further built up the capacity of the United States to engage in direct military intervention in the Middle East by transforming the Rapid Deployment Force into the Central Command in 1983. The Central Command's area of operation was the entire Middle East, and it is the military unit which fought both Gulf Wars I and II. Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, authored a defense guidance for 1984-88 in which he wrote the following: "Whatever the circumstances, we should be prepared to introduce American forces directly into the region should it appear that the security of the access to Persian Gulf oil is threatened." The Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990 overcame the reluctance of Persian Gulf oil states to grant the United States military bases in the region. So since the fall of 1990, the United States has had an increasing number of military bases, which appear to be, at this point, permanent military bases in the region, although they're shifting around. More of them were in Saudi Arabia. The presence in Saudi Arabia is scheduled to be phased out by the end of this year. But the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, did not create a new world order, as President Bush I proclaimed. Indeed, the United States betrayed the uprisings of the Shia and the Kurds in the spring of 1991 after President Bush called on those groups to rise up against Saddam Hussein. And this indicated the reluctance of the Bush I administration to radically alter the regional status quo. This is because democracy was a threat to Saudi Arabia and the other conservative oil-producing states like Kuwait. And it was because the idea of autonomy or independence for the Iraqi Kurds was considered a strong threat to Turkey, a NATO ally. As a result, the United States allowed Saddam Hussein to remain in power during the 1990s while crippling the country and its population through the devastating sanctions regime. But shortly after the betrayal of the uprising of the Shia and the Kurds, the neoconservatives began to develop a critique of the abandonment of the Shia and the Kurds, and to argue during the Clinton administration that the United States should have finished the job. Paul Wolfowitz, who was number three in the Bush I Pentagon, wrote in his 1992 defense planning guidance a new policy that presaged the current policy of massive intervention, preemptive war, and global domination. That policy, in brief, is one of proposing that the United States ought actively to pursue global domination. We ought to export American-style democracy which is applicable everywhere in the world. And if necessary, the United States ought to be prepared to use unilateral military action to achieve these goals. After this document was leaked to the press, President Bush the First ordered that it be rewritten because he considered it too radical. But this is the document that has been guiding Bush 2 administration policy, and it's that vision which guided the lobbying activity of the neoconservatives during the 1990s during the Clinton administration and immediately after September 11, 2001. During the mid-1990s, the lobbying campaign to attack Iraq was spearheaded by William Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard and the director of the Project for a New American Century. The lobbying campaign was rather successful and led in 1998 to passage of the Iraq Liberation Act, which under the Clinton administration already proclaimed that regime change and not simply disarmament was the policy of the United States vis-a-vis Iraq. Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress was selected under the Clinton administration as the chosen representative of the Iraqi regime, of the Iraqi people, and Operation Desert Fox was launched in December of 1998, a joint American-British action which brought an end to the UNSCOM inspection regime, all of this done by the Clinton administration. September 11th provided the opportunity for the Bush 2 neoconservatives to implement the doctrine which had first been articulated by Paul Wolfowitz nearly a decade later. Having begun by mentioning the British Empire in the Middle East, I want to, for a few moments, you'll indulge me because I'm a historian, conduct a brief comparison between the British Empire and the emerging American Empire in the Middle East. The height of the British Empire was between 1815 and the start of World War I in 1914. During that period, Britain was a net exporter of manufactured goods and the largest net importer of raw materials from the rest of the world. The United States at this time has a huge trade deficit and is no longer a leading manufacturing nation. Two, the British ruled typically through local intermediaries, a system known as indirect rule. The British had no intention to export their political system and in fact thought that it was completely impossible to imagine doing so in most cases. If the United States seeks to export democracy, as Paul Wolfowitz and his ideological followers assert, is our objective, this will require a much higher level of permanent engagement in terms of both troops and finances than the British Empire ever spent on maintaining its imperial domination. Third, the British dominated the seas. They never could and never aspired to dominate the entire globe, so their empire was constructed on an entirely different infrastructure. And finally, a point worth noting, the British came to grief over Palestine due to their inability to square the circle of their commitments to Arabs and Zionists. The United States is even less able than the British to square the circle of its commitments to Israel and the surrounding Arab states. Look at the record so far as an indication of how likely it is that the United States will fail ultimately in the Middle East. Afghanistan, the first imperial move after September 11th. Hamid Karzai, the president installed by the United States, has no real power outside Kabul, and security outside the capital is extremely limited. The warlords are back in power in several of the provinces. Once again, Afghanistan is the leading source of opium production in the world. Iraq. There was inadequate planning for the establishment of post-war democratic institutions, for the establishment of law and order, and for economic reconstruction. 55 Americans have died since the end of the war was proclaimed on May 1st, nearly one every day. Basic services, electricity, and water have not been restored, and delays in restoring them strengthen the hand of those opposed to the American presence in Iraq. The most popular political element in Iraq appears to be the Islamic forces of the Shia. They are now divided and they don't have a unified view, but collectively they clearly represent the single largest political grouping in Iraq. No one in the Bush 2 administration predicted any of these developments. Why not? Elections in Najaf were canceled last week because the leading candidate for the mayor was an Islamist. who else would be the leading candidate for mayor in a city which is the burial site of Ali, who is the leading figure in Shia Islam? No democracy is in sight whatsoever in Iraq. In Israel and Palestine, the roadmap is a sham. It is going nowhere fast. We don't have time to get into the details, but I'll be happy to discuss that during the question and answer session. Failure in all of these cases is partly a result of unwillingness or inability to appreciate local political circumstances. Further examples are on the horizon. We have been threatening Syria and Iran in ways that make no sense. Syria is a secular state and prepared to collaborate with the United States. Threats to Iran strengthen the hand of the hardliners against the insurgent reformist movement. The United States cannot control the entire Middle East despite its overwhelming military force. It could not even control its NATO ally Turkey, a relatively democratic country which simply could not go along with the attack on Iraq because a parliamentary majority was not obtained. Global dominance is impossible. The American people are not willing to invest the lives and treasure necessary for the attempt to impose a Pax Americana. The United States economy is relatively weak. We import huge quantities of manufacturing items and have a permanent trade deficit. The public supports protectionism. There are serious structural weaknesses in the American economy. It is not on the verge of collapse, but the American people may not be willing to pay the bill for military adventures that will likely diminish rather than increase our security.
Thank you, Joel. Before I introduce our next speaker, I want to also point out two other publications. One is a book by one of our other senior fellows, Robert Higgs, a book called Crisis and Leviathan. This particular book, we think, is particularly telling these days in the aftermath of 9/11, for which there's been this huge surge of government power economically in the area of civil liberties and, of course, in foreign affairs. And Higgs essentially explains why this happens and how it's been happening during crises for many years. The other publication is the Independent Review, which is the quarterly journal of the Institute, also edited by Bob Higgs. Anyone who has not seen it, I highly recommend it, and it deals with both domestic and foreign affairs issues.